ourselves, miniature universes. Consciously, we all expand and 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 expand. Time for
Så, det här är då yogapodden nummer 8 och med oss har vi Brad Warner som är en amerikansk scenlärare. Han har kommit till scen via att spela i punkband. Han har bott i Japan många år, skrivit många spännande böcker, en av de sex sinnen zen som jag har läst med stort nöje. Och visst finns det någon liten kontakt med yoga också. Welcome Brad to the yoga pod, the yoga radio sessions.
Hello.
So, hardcore zen.
Well, Hardcore Zen is basically the name of a book I wrote. Sometimes people think that it means I teach something called Hardcore Zen, but it was the name of the book came about because I was in a hardcore punk band when I started practicing Zen, and I wrote about that in the book. So there isn't a Hardcore Zen. I feel like the kind of Zen I teach is very... people think I'm iconoclastic or teaching something unusual, but I don't think it's all that unusual. It's a part of the tradition.
So from punk rock to Zen, from bass to being a priest of Buddhism, could that be a correct description?
Well, yes, and also I didn't switch from one to the other, though. I'm still in the same hardcore punk band, and I still play bass. So a lot of people like the story where somebody goes from the life of sin and, you know, whatever, decadence, and then becomes a holy person. But I never left the life of sin and decadence. You know, I'm still just about the same. But I did get into Zen as a way of, I don't know, understanding that a little more deeply.
So what do you do in Sweden? What's your mission here?
What was my mission in Sweden? Oh, I don't know. I came here at the invitation of a strange Mexican man who lives here and wanted me to lead a retreat. So yesterday I led a retreat here in Stockholm. And tomorrow I'm going to be in Berlin. So I'm just traveling around Europe. Leading different retreats and talking to people about what I do.
I don't see any extended limo meeting up with you. you don't want to call yourself a master, but rather a teacher. Why is that?
Yeah, I think the word master is a problem. There is a word zenji in Japanese, which means zen master, if you actually take the word and take apart the pieces. But it usually people don't call you zenji until you're dead. In Japan. And I think it's really strange to hear living people being called Zen master or even calling themselves Zen master. I don't like the term. My first teacher's teacher said nobody masters Zen. So I figure all I am is a teacher, and I'm not even sure I'm a teacher. I'm just sort of a guy who does this, and if people want to come and join me, they can come and join me. I don't know if I have anything to teach anybody.
Anyway, I was joining you yesterday for a satsang for this retreat, and I was intrigued because I tried the Vipassana meditation. It's very rough, it's tough, you sit for hours. Yeah. Here you sit first 15 minutes, you stare into the wall with your open eyes. To make long story short, it was human. Because you got up in between the meditation sessions, yeah, and you walked around the room. So that was... that was very nice. So, just shortly, what is Zen?
Sometimes I don't know. I mean, people when they ask that question usually want a kind of a nice, pretty answer like Zen is the flower of the, you know, whatever, something like that. Historically speaking, it was a movement started in China to try to recover what might have been the earliest idea, the earliest form of Buddhism, which was just Buddha sitting on a rock and trying to experience his life as it really was. And they were trying to get back to that and kind of uncover the original form. But interestingly enough, they chose to also leave in some of the other things that had grown up around it. So in some ways, Zen resembles a religion, because we have services and we have chanting and we have special places where we do the practice. But I think it's ultimately a form of individual introspection, which you, instead of doing by yourself, you do it with a group of people. So even before Buddha's time, there were people who sat and tried to find out the true meaning of life by looking deeply into themselves, because the idea is, the true meaning of life might be out there in the vast universe, but if I am part of the universe, then I can also look inward and look in myself. So people had been doing that by themselves for a long time, and I think my way of understanding it is that the only innovation Buddha did, which I think is a great one, is he tried to find a way to make it something that we could do together. You know, in a group, and that has
it is no religion.
I don't think so. There, it depends on what you mean by religion. There are some people who, depending on how they describe what they think of as a religion, then they would say yes, it's a religion. But the reason I say it's not a religion is because there's no belief system. There's no book. There's no idea that you must believe certain things to follow the Zen practice. You could be a Christian and follow it. You could be Muslim. I've met Muslims who follow Zen practice. There's no conflict from the Zen side. There might be a conflict from the Muslim side or the Christian side. I don't know. But from the Zen side, there's no problem what you believe. And there's no book, which is the authoritative single book that we must follow or anything. So in that way, I think it's not a religion.
So what does Zen offer you? It seems that you're it's a kind of a contradictory or opposite forces. You come from the punk rock scene, you work with Godzilla-like movies, and then you're interesting. What's in it for you?
Well, I discovered it kind of early in life. I was about 18 years old, I think, and I was a student at a university, and I just accidentally stumbled upon Zen. But the reason I got into punk rock and the reason I got into Zen were pretty much the same, which is because I wanted to find something true, and I was very interested in rock music and everything. So I found that the truest form of rock music at the time was the hardcore punk scene, because it was the most honest and unpretentious. People didn't care about becoming famous, they didn't care about anything but making the music and having the experience of coming together for the music. So I really admired the purity of that. And Zen also seemed to be looking into the truth, but even looking at it more deeply. I always used to say that I thought when I first discovered Zen, it was the most punk rock thing I ever heard, because punk rock was all about questioning, the politics and the status quo and the music industry and all of that. And Zen to me took the same attitude of questioning, but also applied it to myself, like saying, okay, I'm questioning everybody else, but what about me? You know, how am I part of this same system that I think I'm rebelling against? You know, how is my rebellion even sometimes aiding and helping the system that I'm rebelling against? It was all these interesting questions. And so I just really liked it because it was very deep and very honest.
It seems that you bring with you from punk, it's an almost anarchistic, unorthodox foundation, it seems, for your translation of Zen, and you seem to attract people who are not, they don't have to have robes. I mean, you have jeans, and I think that you consciously also make a point of it. You want to attract people, other people, new people.
I guess so. You know, I I don't know if it's as deliberate as that. I have the Buddhist robes, but I feel really uncomfortable in them. And when I wear them, people respond to me differently. They seem to see me as a different person, and I get a kind of worship from it, and this kind of veneration that feels very uncomfortable. So I don't wear them, and I just wear the clothes that I would normally wear. But when I'm doing a ceremony or something, I put on the robes, because I think you should, you know, that's part of the ceremony, is somebody who's wearing the robes. It's like a costume. But as far as like attracting people and being unorthodox, I feel like the Zen tradition has always had this very rebellious portion to it. It's something I've been thinking about a lot lately. So there is institutionalized Zen represented in Japan by very large institutions, such as one called Soto Shu, which is a huge international organization that's a little bit like the Vatican, but not exactly, not as big as the Vatican, of course. And then there's this other side to it. So one of the things I think is real interesting, I don't know if your listeners will think, but I'll just say it, is, for example, I have a teacher who is a Zen, so-called Zen master, and he made me a so-called Zen master by doing some ceremonies and stuff. And because of that, I can make anyone else a Zen master if I want to, and I can decide any way I want to do it.
So I give you $200 and I become Zen master today. Sure. That's great.
if I felt like it, I could do that.
What's your account number?
I think that's an important part of the tradition, is this almost anarchic way of doing the things, because no one, if I make you a Zen master, you know, if I just decided over this table to make you a Zen master today, no one could say, oh no, you're not a real Zen master, because I have the authority to do that. On the other hand, there is also a tradition, a more institutional tradition, where you have to go through a certain number of hours of training and so forth, to become legitimatized. So there's always been, maybe not always, there are existing today two very different ways to do it. The way I did it through my teacher is the much more older traditional way. So I didn't have any specific training as such. I didn't go through a seminary or anything like that. I just stuck with this teacher for many, many years, and he finally thought, okay, he's ready. He gave me a piece of paper, and now I'm a Zen teacher. So I think it's important to keep these both the sort of rebellious side and the institutional side as well.
And you're not so happy with the way that the American Buddhism is developing? Is it sort of institutionalized, conform, church-like?
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting what's going on in America, because the Zen teachers who came to America initially in the 1950s and 60s were generally the kind of rebellious ones who wanted to kind of bring back the older way of just doing it kind of by feeling and intuition and not being so institutional. But then as those teachers started dying, what happened is a lot of their students became afraid of the chaotic nature of this, and they go back to Japan and they study how the Japanese people do it and the institutional side of the Japanese version, and they go, oh, we need to have that. We need to have an institution and requirements and all of this. I think it's a mistake, but I also think it's unavoidable.
Okay, so I read this book, Sex, Sin, and Zen, with a lot of pleasure. So why choose the topic of sex? Why not a book about celibacy?
Well, it is a little bit about celibacy, yeah. But yeah, the book came out of something I was doing for a few years before I wrote the book, which is that this website called Suicide Girls asked me to write a regular, blog for Suicide Girls.
A soft porn site.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, most people would call it. They always hated it if you called it soft porn, but yeah, most people would call it soft porn.
But already there. I mean, you're shut out of the church or the community of Buddhists.
A little bit, yeah. But I thought it sounded like a good opportunity to. I thought, well, this is a little unorthodox. But then again, if I don't write about Zen on Suicide Girls, then nobody writes about Zen on Suicide Girls, and I don't think that's better, you know. So I decided to write, and I just because of the people, you know, they come to Suicide Girls because they're feeling horny or whatever, and so sex is a topic that often came up, and through different articles I wrote and conversations I had with people, I decided what was interesting to me is I decided I would write a book about sex and Buddhism. When I decided that, I thought, okay, probably there's, you know, 5 or 6 books already about this topic. And so I go on Google and researched it, and there were only 2 books I could find on the topic, and both of them turned out to be very good books, but both of them were only interested in history. So they were talking about how sex functioned in Buddhism up until maybe 500 years ago, and then they stopped. And I thought, well, let's talk about how sex is dealt with in Buddhism today. And I was surprised that nobody was writing about it. And still, that book came out 4 years ago, I think, and still I haven't seen anybody else write about the topic.
And one of the most interesting parts of the book is an interview with a porn star, and it develops into it's really a book where you always come back to Buddhism in one way or the other. But I love this passage. You're in a room full of pompous wannabe Buddhists, all trying to be pure of heart and mind. I just want to rip my clothes off, plug my Stratocaster into a stack of morsels, and blow the fake ass beatific smiles off their faces.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel that way. You know, it's just I always feel like the opposite of the situation I'm in. But the interview you mentioned, it was Nina Hartley is the name of the woman who I interviewed. And my girlfriend at the time had a book called Nina Hartley's Guide to Hot Sex. And I thought, okay. And she said, here, look at this book. And I'm thinking, well, you know, I don't know what she's asking me to look at the book for. So she says, no, look at this page, you know, the first page. And in there is a dedication. And mentioned in the dedication are, I think, like 4 or 5 people whose names I recognize as being members of San Francisco Zen Center. And I thought, why is she, you know, why is she mentioning in the thank yous all these people from San Francisco Zen Center? So the next time I was at San Francisco Zen Center, I said, do you know about this? Why is she doing this? And she said, no, she's the daughter of 2 of our longtime members of the Zen Center. And so I through my contacts at Suicide Girls, I got in contact with her, and she was very interested to talk to me about Zen and about sex and about porn. And I found that I wanted to put her interview in and put the things she said exactly as they were. I don't necessarily agree with everything she said. I mean, some of it I agree with, some of it I think, well, that's just her experience. Nothing she said I really disagree with, but it's not my experience. So I wanted to have her experience in the book.
It seems that all through the book, the bottom line is you don't condemn people, but you sort of kick them forward to finding their own way of living. And it's the same. You do have opinions, but you're not condemning, and you seem to not saying what is right and what is wrong, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no point in me saying what is right and what is wrong, because who cares what I think about what's right and what's wrong? You know, I'm just a person like anybody else. So I think we all have to live our lives and determine for ourselves what's right and wrong in our specific situation, depending on what comes to us. You know, so if in Nina Hartley's case, you know, all of this work as a porn star came to her, and she also had the background in Zen and in this philosophy of treating everybody with respect and care, and she brought that into being a porn actress, which is very unusual because most people in that industry don't care about those things. I don't know about most people, but it's not very common.
It's not very common with this sadomasochistic porn star mixture with it. I love it.
Yeah, so I think condemning people and telling them what's right and wrong, it you just have to make it up for yourself. And you can look at other people and look at their examples. I think that's useful. But sometimes when somebody presents themselves as being so pure, almost always they turn out to be terrible. So this is just my experience. I would rather present myself as being terrible and then have people being surprised, going, oh, he's not really that terrible. Than the other side, which is presenting myself as being so pure and wonderful, and then they find out some scandal about me. I haven't had the scandal yet, but I'm waiting for it.
Yes, we all wait eagerly. Can you just describe, for a layman, for someone who has not been into Zen before, what is the sort of outline of the Zazen? What is Zazen?
Zazen practice is, I think, first off, it's a lot of people, when they study meditation, they study it as if it's a mental discipline. And Zazen includes both a mental side and a physical side. And often, because people are so used to hearing only about the mental side of these meditation practices, sometimes when I explain it, I just talk about the physical side, which is you sit on a cushion, you try to keep your back straight, you keep your eyes open, and you stay very still. When your posture starts to go badly, because mind and body are really one and the same, are really the same thing, if your mind goes in a strange way, your body will also follow that. So when I sit Zazen, the thing I pay most attention to is my body. So I just look and see, am I sitting straight? Is everything balanced? I think in a lot of ways it's like a yoga balance pose. You know, in yoga you have the tree pose, and if you get off balance in the tree pose, you know it immediately because you fall over. In Zazen, you're sitting on your butt, so if you lose your balance, you don't fall over. But you can notice it if you learn how to notice when you're losing your balance.
And you don't have a mantra.
No mantra.
And you told us yesterday that we should not try to avoid or control thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's the explanation I always use, which I used yesterday, comes from Shohaku Okumura, who's a Japanese Zen teacher who lives in America. And he said that thoughts are the secretion of your mind, just like stomach acid is the secretion of your stomach. And I think that's a good way of thinking of it, because the same way, if you're just sitting in meditation and your stomach is digesting what you ate for breakfast, like mine is right now, you don't try to control that. You don't try to make it digest the sausages first and digest the bread next and stop. You don't try to stop the digestion from happening because you think you should be, clear of having digestion. The same way you think of what your brain is doing. So your brain is active, no matter what, and that activity that happens in your brain is perceived by you as thought. So you don't try to control your thoughts or try to make them stop. You allow them to happen, but you do what is another Zen teacher calls opening the hand of thought. So it's as if the thoughts are in your hand and you're holding them tight, and instead of holding them tight, you just open your hand and let them go. So that's what we're trying to do, is not make the thoughts stop, but also not follow them wherever they want to lead us. One teacher, I think it was Shunryu Suzuki, said it's like you open your door to the thoughts and let them come in and drink tea, but you don't invite them to stay. So right. they just go.
So when we enter this the void of Zen and opens up for us, are we expected to live a certain kind of way? You have one chapter in the book with a question, can Buddhists jerk off? So can they?
Yeah, that was a I actually was giving a talk in Montreal a few years ago, and some person asked that question. Really interesting guy. I wish I'd gotten to know him better, because I talked to him a little bit after the talk. He was a funny guy. But I thought about that question, and the answer in early Buddhism is no. The early Buddhists were expected, the first group that Buddha had, were expected to be totally celibate. So they not only didn't have sex, they weren't allowed to even masturbate. I look at that myself, and I think, of course, some Buddhists would get angry if I said this, but others wouldn't care. Which is, I think Buddha made a mistake by making that rule. I think maybe he just didn't know enough about how humans are, and maybe he was a little too idealistic when he made that rule. So I think in the Zen form of Buddhism, there's no such rule like that. You can masturbate all you want. But it encourages you to look at every activity clearly. So if you're masturbating, you are fully immersed in masturbation. I'm sorry to talk about this on your nice show, but so it just becomes something that you're doing at that moment, and then you let it go at the next moment. It isn't right or wrong in itself. It can be wrong if you become addicted to it, or if you become obsessed with your masturbation fantasies and try to make them real in the world and force other people to do things that they don't like to do, etc., etc. But in and of itself, just the act of masturbation is simply something you do to relieve a condition. You know, I don't think it's good or bad.
Yeah, you write about these highs that we strive for. I mean, mm-hmm. in Sweden there's something called kick addicted. Yeah. Addicted to kicks, and you go through them, and you talk about drugs,
yeah.
And you talk about the fact that if you get high on something, including spiritual bliss, there's always going to be a low.
It always happens. It seems like it's a little bit like going up a roller coaster, and if you go up really, really high on the roller coaster, then you have to come down. Of course, coming down can be fun if you're on a roller coaster, so maybe it's not a good analogy. But usually every time I've been on drugs, there's always some kind of bounce back. So, you do what you do, but you also try to... I was trying to explain it to these French women who came to a retreat years and years ago, and they hated the retreat because they thought it was trying to take away their ability to enjoy life, and because I was talking about remaining even in life, and they were like, we like the highs and the lows, we want to have the highs and the lows. And I was saying, well, you have the highs and the lows, but if you actually find the spot where everything is even and balanced, it's not a sad place to be. It actually feels very good, and it almost feels more like being high than being low, if you want to say one or the other. It's not like you're giving something up, you're just giving up the, you know, it's like a rubber band, you pull the rubber band and then snap it, you know, it always comes back to the set point,
like a boomerang.
Yeah, like a boomerang. So if you try to remain in that set point, then sometimes you'll have the highs and you'll have the lows, and you can still enjoy them as much as you ever did. I find I enjoy them more, you know, so because I can be fully present when they happen.
You summarize it in two sentences here. The real goal of Zen is to find a way of life that's easy and undramatic.
Yeah.
Strong attachments lead to upset and drama. So for all of us drama queens and drama kings,
yeah.
This is something to dwell on.
Yeah, I think that the drama always pulls me away from the more important things going on. I always feel like one of the reasons, one of the things that interested me when I first started practicing is I discovered a huge area of life which I felt like I had been ignoring until then. So up until I started doing the Zen practice, my life had been like, oh, the big concert or the sex or, you know, some exciting moment, that my mind was just filled with that. And when those things weren't going on, I was looking at the rest of life going, oh, this is boring. This is boring. I don't care about this. I'm thinking about other things. And I just remember a few times, for example, because I was a university student and didn't have a good car, I was waiting for buses a lot, right? So I was just standing at a bus stop going, oh, this experience, I would have missed this experience of standing at this bus stop by thinking, oh, this is ordinary and I don't care about it. But I thought, well, I want to fully appreciate standing at this bus stop and just be there. And it was interesting because it seemed to like open up into something incredible. I thought standing at a bus stop was boring, but then I realized standing at a bus stop isn't boring at all. And riding on the bus isn't boring at all. You know, it's really amazing if you just feel each sensation as it happens and each moment as it happens. And I thought, oh my God, I've missed out, you know, 70% of my life because I thought it was boring. And now I feel like, oh, it's never boring. There's always something.
So that's actually your high, your trip right now. I read that before, that the goal of a Buddhist should be to, when you wash the dishes, it might have been boring before, but you are present, you do it, and you enjoy it.
Yeah, that's the one I always hate, because that's my most hated chore, is washing dishes. Like I even most people avoid washing the toilet because that's disgusting. I think washing the toilet is much better than washing the dishes. I don't know why. Maybe it's because you can, you know, it feels more accomplishment or something. So yeah, that's a standard Zen thing to talk about, or just chopping the wood or whatever. But you can even, you know, those are, sometimes I avoid those kind of examples because it sounds so ancient and oriental and everything. But you know, you go like, oh, the bus stop, you know, or sitting doing your tax return, you know, finding the actual joy in being in a traffic jam and not moving and you're late for where you want to be. That's really interesting.
That's the real challenge.
Yeah.
Like yesterday, 1 hour in.
Mm-hmm. Well, I live in Los Angeles, so I've been in plenty of those. And I thought, sometimes I think, okay, maybe I don't need to be in that place. You know, maybe this is the place I need to be, stuck in this traffic with all this smoke and...
So do you see any connection between Zen and yoga?
Well, yeah, I do. A lot of the retreats that I lead, we've added yoga to the retreat. My teacher didn't do that. He was very purist. He thought your practice should be very purely involved in the Zen when you do a retreat. So sometimes I wonder if he's looking down on me from Buddhist hell or wherever he went, you know, thinking I'm doing wrong. But I think that, and even actually he said this too, Zen comes from the yoga tradition. The posture, the Padmasana, the lotus posture that we do, is based on a yoga posture. And Buddha specifically selected that posture as being the posture he wanted to base his practice on. So it does come from the yoga tradition, and I think yoga can also help. Because like we did yesterday, you helped us go through the hip openers and things. If you're sitting for a long time, it's very important to have flexible hips, and it can make the sitting feel much better, and you don't become so distracted by the pain and that kind of thing. So I think they're very complementary.
Good. I just have to ask you not to put down your arms because of the mic. So either you have them here or you have them here.
Okay. I'll try to remember.
Thank you. So what's the most common question that you get from newbies or people that are interested in yoga? What's the ordinary question?
Well, the most common question I get from people who want to know about Zen is it always goes exactly the same way. It's a pattern. It usually comes by email. Sometimes I get it in person. But it starts off with, I have been doing Zen practice for, and then it says how many years. And now, whenever I do Zen, I think about, and then sometimes it's just a few sentences, and sometimes people write me an email that just goes on and on and on and on, describing in great detail what they think. And then the end of the question is, am I doing it wrong? And I feel like the answer is you're not doing it wrong. It's just, whenever I came to my teacher with a question like that, he had one answer, and he would say, that's just the content of your zazen. So at that moment, you know, it's thoughts about this and that and the other thing. So it doesn't matter. You just, whatever thought comes to your mind, you, as much as possible, try to let it go. You don't try to stop it. You don't try to make it not happen, but you try to let it just go.
Can you say that it's a sort of extraction, of filtering? So maybe you have 25, 50 things buzzing in your head, and when the zazen practice is over, you sort of are more focused. Maybe you have extracted or filtered up three things to focus on.
That's an interesting question. It could be. My teacher said something, and I think he only said it once, but I always remember it. He said, somebody was asking him about, I don't think it was even me, and he said, zazen allows you to think practical thoughts. And I was so surprised, because I thought zazen was about not thinking. And I realized that because you are letting the thoughts have the exact weight and importance that they need to have, it sometimes becomes much easier to figure out which ones need to be attended to.
It's like the sleeping elephant they talk about in TM, that you, through your mantra, you wake up the sleeping elephant. Maybe that's the important thing.
Ah, yeah, could be, yeah. Mm. Yeah, it sort of seems like that. I just start to look at what comes up, and if something comes up that's unexpected, I think, maybe that's something I need to look at. But I try to hold even that thought lightly, because if you try to grab too hard, it just goes away and you don't have it anymore. I find the mind does interesting things. I've even found myself sitting in zazen trying to solve a problem, and my mind is working very, very, very hard on the problem. And then, because my posture is getting bad or whatever, I notice it. And I suddenly notice that the problem my mind was working on doesn't even exist. Like, there's no, like, I try to think, well, what was that problem? And there's no problem. It's just the mind went into that mode of must solve the problem, you know, and it just goes blue, 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 you know, and it's trying to solve this problem. And then you say, no, mind, there's no problem. You don't need to do that. It's just an activity that happens, you know, because of habit, who knows why it happens, but you don't need to worry about it so much.
So for you as a teacher, what is your biggest challenge?
Biggest challenge, I suppose, is being a teacher, if you want to know the honest truth from me, because of the way I got into it, which is, like I said at the beginning, I was a punk rock kid, and I got into Zen very accidentally, and I got into it because I wanted to do it for myself. So I didn't have any notion of becoming a teacher. I never thought about it. You know, it was just something I did for myself, and I'd been doing it for years and years and years. And then my teacher, Nishijima Roshi, said, you should teach. And I said, but I don't want to teach. And he said, yeah, I know you don't want to teach, but you should teach. You know, he kind of gently pushed me into the situation. And he even ended up kind of forcing the situation. You know, it was very funny what he did, because he was pretty old by then. And he gave me this ceremony called Dharma Transmission, which means I'm, you know, so-called master. But after that, I wasn't doing anything. I just had the ceremony. So maybe after a few months, he says, he asked me to come to talk to him. And he says, you know, I've been teaching these Saturday classes in English for many years, and I'm very old, and it's tiring. Would you mind teaching the classes in English? And what am I going to say? You know, if I say no, I'm being mean to my, you know, teacher who's this, you know, old man and becoming very tired. So I said, okay, I started doing that. And then a few months after that, he said, I've been doing these retreats in English for many years. I'm becoming very tired. Would you mind taking over the retreats in English? And I was like, I don't want to take over the retreats in English. That's so much work and so many people. But I said, okay, I'll take over the retreats in English. And after I got used to it, I discovered I could also, this was a way for me to increase my own study of the practice. So when I teach, what I am doing, sorry to disappoint anybody who comes to my retreat, is I'm doing it for myself. I'm doing it so that I can learn more about Zen. And if somebody happens to be in the room and hears it and it's helpful to them, then that's good. You know, that's fine. But I don't, even when I'm writing books, I'm not trying to tell anybody anything. I'm trying to work on the problem for myself, and the writing the books and speaking about it is a way to do that. And I'm glad it helps people. I think it's nice, and they come and say, oh, you helped me. And I listen to it and I go, yeah, I'm glad it helped you, but that wasn't really what I was trying to do.
So you tried to detach from that sort of confirmation of yourself, your self-ego.
Well, yeah, I guess
boost,
so.
The boost of your self-ego.
I guess so. I mean, the thing is, and this is something I think about a lot lately, is you can get, if you do the kind of job I do, you can get a very big ego boost. It's so seductive. I was in America a couple of months ago, and a guy invited me to lunch, and he was very, he was a very sweet man. He was really nice. So I don't want to say anything bad to him in case he hears this, but he was so excited to be with me. You know, he read my books and everything, and he goes, "You're a gift." And I thought, oh no, I'm not a gift. You know,
a gift to humanity.
Yeah, but you know, I think if you hear that a lot, it can go to your head, you know, and you become very seduced by it, and you go, well, I am a gift. I'm going to give my gift to everybody. And to me, that's a very dark place to go into, and it's kind of dangerous. People can get stuck there for a long time. You know, and I think there's no way to avoid getting a little bit stuck there. So I think even I, when I try to avoid it, I still get stuck there a little bit. But I always try to recognize, oh, I'm getting stuck on the...
But you learned a little from the other traders of spiritual insights with your merchandise.
Yeah.
T-shirts. I think sit down and shut up, it says on my t-shirt.
Oh, these are great
and that
t-shirts.
Might be a message for all of us blabbers. I remember when I was in therapy, suddenly my therapist said, shut up.
Yeah. That's great. I never thought a therapist said that.
But he loved me. I could sense in his eyes that he loved me. So it was okay. I was blabbing too much. So.
Well, I think I blabbed too much too. But you know, like the merchandise and the books and the dana, which is the donations people give, you know, everybody has to make a living somehow. So it's this is another part you have to be careful with, because it's, you know, you learn as you go along which things you say are the ones that excite people and which ones aren't. And so you can tailor it, and you can find like, oh, I can make more money if I say these things. But I feel like personally I have to be really careful. And sometimes I even do and say things that I know will hurt my status. Because sometimes they think, oh, it's getting too big, so I better say some things to offend people so that a few people go away. I don't want the core people who are really, really interested to go away, because I think that's we're on a journey together. But then there's this sort of outside group who are just excited by something, and you know, they don't really help. so you kind of learn. I think I kind of try to gently say, why don't you go look at somebody else?
Yeah, so it's actually a non-guru guru. I have two more questions. Mm-hmm. Just personal interest. There are two, vad heter begrepp på engelska? I get the suggestion here for. So there are two terms or two words in Buddhism that also has spread to popular culture. For example, Dharma.
Yeah.
We have the Jack Kerouac book, Dharma Bums.
Mm-hmm.
We have Bodhisattva, we have the Steely Dan song.
Yeah, yeah.
Bodhisattva, won't you take me by the hand? So first, what is Dharma?
Well, Dharma has a lot of meanings. Traditionally, when you say Dharma, you are talking about the teachings of Buddha. You know, that's like the basic meaning. But it also means the truth, and it means it means something bigger. Like Dogen, who is the guy who started the version of Zen that I studied mostly, he uses the Dharma sometimes to mean a much wider universal kind of truth. So it's something you try to align yourself with, or try to get. It's sort of like a magnet. You're trying to find the place where you're in the same alignment, like I said, of this Dharma, and to me that's what Dharma is, and it's a kind of a universal thing that's available wherever you go and in any situation, and anytime you go against it, it's painful. Maybe not very painful. Maybe there's some pleasure mixed in, but the pleasure will always kind of turn back on itself and become painful later. So you kind of watch and learn these things as they happen, and the more sensitive you become, the quicker you can kind of know that, oh, I'm doing this thing that feels really good now, but it's not the right thing to do. So you go, okay, maybe I stop doing that.
It's kind of being true to yourself.
It's being true to yourself in the sense of being true to the universe operating through you. I think we're all involved in this kind of great project, and none of us individually will ever understand what the project is. You know, it's much too big for any person to get, and we'll die without ever knowing what part we played in the project. But that doesn't mean we can't play that part. You learn to do that part. And I feel that we are also connected to the wider universe, so that even though we as ourselves, as individuals, don't understand what we're doing, there's some deeper part which is also very much connected to us that does understand. So you try to find the area where those match and pursue that way. But sometimes you fail, and you know, then once you fail, Dogen has this phrase, he says, when you fall on the ground, you get up by using the ground. You know, so the same thing that made you fall and hurt you is the thing that you use to get right again. So I think that's important. And was the other term?
The other popular culture reference with the band Steely Dan.
Oh, right. We were
talking about, they had this song about Bodhisattva. So right. What is Bodhisattva?
Yeah, and Beastie Boys also had a song called Bodhisattva. Yeah, it's a Bodhisattva. It traditionally meant a person. In early Buddhism, there was this idea of the Arhat. And the Arhat was somebody who pursued Buddhist practice to the ultimate aim, and eventually disappeared as an individual from the universe and merged into everything. And this was the attractive idea that people were pursuing. Later on, this idea developed of the Bodhisattva, and it was planted by Buddha in his earliest talks, but it became emphasized much later as the person who is also trying to reach the ultimate, but is trying to bring others along with her or with him. Bodhisattva could be a man or a woman, doesn't matter.
So you're a kind of Bodhisattva?
Well, yeah, I don't know. But a Bodhisattva sounds too big, but it's you say, I will not enter Nirvana until everyone else, you know, so you're trying to open the door for everybody else and hold the door open, like that guy, the guy they wrote about a book who was on the, there was a plane crash and he kept helping everybody onto the life raft or something, and then he actually died because he kept helping them.
The bouncer at the rock club letting everybody in.
Maybe, yeah. And he doesn't get to go by himself. But the idea of the Bodhisattva is eventually the Bodhisattva also enters into it. And so that's the idea. I don't know. I have a friend named Rob Robbins who said this wonderful thing. Because the Bodhisattva vow says, I vow to save all beings. And Rob said, I think that means I vow to save all beings from myself. And I thought, that's the way to understand it, because I'm not really trying to rescue them like Superman or something. I'm trying to trying to not cause more problems, you know? So if I can stop causing problems in the world, then that can be a great contribution, even though it seems kind of small. But I think we underestimate how great that contribution is, just to try. And sometimes you're going to cause problems. It's just unavoidable, because that's the nature of being alive, is you cause some problem for somebody. But as long as your aim is to avoid causing any problems that aren't necessary, then you help a lot, and I think that's a good thing to do.
I think that's a good roundup. So Brad Warner is trying to save people from himself.
Yeah,
and we really want to make the listeners read your books or recommend your books. Yeah. There's a lot of them. So just Google Brad Warner and find out for yourself. And thank you so much for taking your time with this interview. Is it something you want to say to the listeners, something in particular?
No. I think thank you for listening, and I think do what you do and find your own way, I think is all I can say.
All right. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Och vi tackar vår sponsor Yes Yoga. Kolla på yesyoga.se. Vi har 4 klasser varje vecka vid telefonplan. Då, Kurt, är det dags för lite avslutande musik. Thank you.